Should be a fun morning this morning. You know, we have really an overwhelming amount of information to get to, and we have weeks to do it. But the thing about studying evolution is that each point you bring raises 10 more questions. It's really hard to know where to start and how to approach the topic. So I appreciate y'all just being patient and bearing with me. I'm trying to figure out the right way to approach the topic. I want to start this morning just by reading the text we all know very well, Genesis chapter 1 on the creation. The theme with me throughout this whole thing is going to be, as I described last week, that for me, and I think many others, and statistics bears this out, is that the theory of evolution can be a great weight on the shoulders of the Christian, kind of like a giant cinder block in your backpack. It's a problem, you know, it's there, it weighs you down in your faith, it makes you question whether the Bible is really true. And for me, you know, I hate doing equipping hour without doing Bible studies, because that's really what we're, you know, primarily what we're here for. But I've found the only way to get those bricks out of your backpack the best way on this one is to look at the theory of evolution itself. And once you look at it closely and begin to understand what it is, those bricks, your backpack will get lighter and lighter. And you'll realize that even these words in the Bible that sound like poetry actually carry a lot more truth and weight and gravity than the so-called scientific theory of evolution. They'll build in credibility. They'll have more power. And you'll realize the scriptures, again, that you thought were kind of poetic about how God holds everything in his hand and he spoke everything into existence, isn't really poetry at all. God is a lot closer than you ever imagined. These scriptures are actually true. And so the only way I know to do that is to look at the theory. So my apologies for us kind of stepping away from the scriptures for a while. We are going to get back into the scriptures and look at scriptures on creation. But first, we got to do this trowel and spade work of looking at the theory. But I do want to just read Genesis 1:1, and I want you to, chapter 1, and just be thinking about, you know, ask yourself, do you think it's true? Or has evolution placed a giant stink bomb right in the middle of chapter 1 that causes you to think that maybe God put some process in motion a billion years ago, and that really he's kind of far away watching all of this from afar, maybe guiding it from a distance? Ask yourself, has evolution had that impact on you? Genesis 1:1, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. The earth was without form and void, and darkness was over the face of the deep, and the Spirit of God was hovering over the face of the waters. And God said, "Let there be light," and there was light. And God saw that the light was good, and God separated the light from the darkness. God called the light day, and the darkness he called night, and there was evening, and there was morning the first day. And God said, "Let there be an expanse in the midst of the waters, and let it separate the waters from the waters." And God made the expanse and separated the waters that were under the expanse from the waters that were above the expanse. This is the atmosphere. And it was so, and God called the expanse heaven, and there was evening, and there was morning the second day. And God said, "Let the waters under the heavens be gathered together into one place, and let the dry land appear." And it was so. God called the dry land earth, and the waters that were gathered together he called seas. And God saw that it was good. And God said, "Let the earth sprout vegetation, plants yielding seed, and fruit trees bearing fruit in which is their seed, each according to its kind, on the earth." And it was so. The earth brought forth vegetation, plants yielding seed according to their own kinds, and trees bearing fruit in which is their seed, each according to its kind. And God saw that it was good. And there was evening, and there was morning the third day. And God said, "Let there be lights in the expanse of the heavens to separate the day from the night." and let them be for signs and for seasons and for days and years, and let them be lights in the expanse of the heavens to give light upon the earth. And it was so. And God made the two great lights, the greater light to rule the day and the lesser light to rule the night and the stars. And God set them in the expanse of the heavens to give light on the earth, to rule over the day and over the night, and to separate the light from the darkness. And God saw that it was good. And there was evening, and there was morning, the fourth day. And God said, let the waters swarm with swarms of living creatures, and let birds fly above the earth across the expanse of the heavens. So God created the great sea creatures and every living creature that moves, with which the waters swarm, according to their kinds, and every winged bird according to its kind. And God saw that it was good. God blessed them, saying, be fruitful and multiply and fill the waters and the seas, and let birds multiply on the earth. And there was evening and there was morning, the fifth day. And God said, let the earth bring forth living creatures according to their kinds, livestock and creeping things and beasts of the earth according to their kinds. And it was so. And God made the beasts of the earth according to their kinds and the livestock according to their kinds and everything that creeps on the ground according to its kind. And God saw that it was good. Then God said, let us make man in our image after our likeness, and let them have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the heavens and over the livestock and over all the earth and over every creeping thing that creeps on the earth. So God made man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them. And God blessed them. And God said to them, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth and subdue it and have dominion over all the fish of the sea and over the birds of the heavens and over every living thing that moves on the earth. And God said, behold, I have given you every plant yielding seed that is on the face of the earth and every tree with seed in its fruit. You shall have them for food. And to every beast of the earth, and to every bird of the heavens, and to everything that creeps on the earth, everything that has the breath of life, I have given every green plant for food. And it was so. And God saw everything he had made, and behold, it was very good. And there was evening, and there was morning, the sixth day. And then, of course, God rests on the seventh day. I just wanted to read that again, that account over and over. You know, I want to read it over and over again, because, again, for many of us, evolution puts a huge obstacle in the way of us reading that in the way that I think it was intended to be read, which is quite literally God created everything by the power of his voice. He's not far. He's near. Jim. Yeah, I mean, it sounds a little theoretical. I mean, I would say, you know, this isn't a dream. I think he has made us real. I think what you're trying to express is the fact that he is really he gives life really to every cell, to every process, to every human, to every creature. And should he withdraw that, it will collapse and it will disappear. I don't think it's in his mind. I don't think we're all in his mind. We're real, you know. We are real. He has created things that are real and separate from him. But he sustains them. If we pull all of creation into him and into his mind, then we kind of step into pantheism and the fact that God is all in all, and it's kind of an illusion. But this is a creation story where God created something outside of himself, and he sustains it.
Well, that's the
right. I know that's what you mean. And scripture is very clear on that. And that he does sustain all of life. And, you know, that again raises a question with evolution. Is it a process with some sort of life force injected by God a billion years ago or 20 billion years ago that is kind of trailed along on its own? Or is he right here, right now, sustaining what he has created? And his spirit and his presence is sustaining every life right here, right now, in this room. That's the nearness of God. Every nanosecond. And that makes a huge difference as to your relationship with God. So I think you're right. Those are the thoughts, Jim, that I want us to have. This morning, we're going to look some at Darwin. So we're going to start sort of from the beginning. We're going to make sure, you know, that we understand the theory of evolution as it came from Darwin and then as it progressed. And if we have time, we're going to move on and look at the geologic column. You remember the column that you saw in your textbooks in school with, the simple creatures down in the deep in the Earth's crust, and then the more complex creatures getting up higher with all the dates down the side. We're going to look at that, where it came from and what it's used for. We're going to look at the dating methods, carbon dating. Somebody say something? Timelines, yeah, okay. I think the scientists usually call it the geologic column, but we either way is fine. We're going to look at carbon dating methods. We're going to look at radiometric dating and a little bit about ice core dating, and just look at them real quickly and see some of the how they work, so you can make sure you understand that. Then we're going to talk a little about genetics and the mutations that have supposedly given rise to all of the change and all the different types of life forms on Earth, and talk about transitional fossils. Once we get done with all that, I'm going to have a special Sunday on the human fossil record, which will be fun. We're going to go through the history of all of the missing links that have been found over the decades, and I'll show you each one of those in some detail. And really where I want you to come out, it won't be hard for you to figure out what I'm doing. What I'm trying to do is show you the theory of evolution and show you the evidence, quote unquote, for evolution. And where I predict and hope that you will come out is you will think that I am lying to you or trying to deceive you. Now, the truth is, I am an advocate against evolution, obviously. I do think it's crazy. And so I may not be the best person to help you hear the other side of the argument. Study it on your own. Question me. Ask me questions. Do your best to try to make sure you understand. Where I think you'll come out is you'll see that the theory is so unsupported and so unsubstantiated. You will probably think I'm exaggerating, which is good, because then you'll go back and study for yourself. And I want you to do that. But then your next question is going to be, if the theory is so crazy and so unsubstantiated, how is it that every university in the entire world has based all of science, biology, chemistry, astronomy, everything, life sciences, everything, and accepted it as fact, hook, line, and sinker? How can that be? And that's where we're going to end up weeks from now. But I want you to be thinking about that. Okay, Darwin. We know that, it's fun to think about, but I don't. Some Christians believe that Genesis, that it did happen in an instance, and that this is a way of kind of stringing it out in a 6-day period. After looking at all those theories and all those interpretations, I'm just kind of left with nothing else but the words on the page. And I'm just thinking, I think it's probably best just to take it at face value. But many good Christians, some of the big Christians throughout history believe that it probably was done in an instant, and that there is some poetry in Genesis 1 to just kind of string it out a little bit so that we can access it a little better. And remember, we are going to talk about, could God, is there a way to merge evolution with creation? And can we just accept evolution and just say, well, maybe God did it. Maybe God made the creatures change in this slow process. As we unpack the theory, though, I think you're going to see you can't mix the two. One is a theory of random creations by random mutations. That's why it took so long. That's why it's so messy. They think that explains the entire theory. In fact, the whole theory was built backwards from that. Okay? Darwin did not discover evolution. He wasn't looking under a microscope. He wasn't observing creatures and went, wow, I just saw something that I have to test. That's not how it happened. He was formulating an idea, a possible idea of how, if God wasn't involved, it would have to be random, And if it were random, what would it have to look like for creatures to appear? Actually, he didn't address how life appeared. He didn't have an answer. But once it appeared, how did it become so varied if there was no guidance and no process? So you see, the whole theory is built backwards from the concept of randomness. So if you try to mix purpose with randomness, you end up with a mess. It doesn't work. Okay? So that's what Darwin did. In Darwin's day, think about it. They didn't know about genes. They didn't know about the complexity of the cell during this time. And so what the way people thought that creatures changed was different than we think of today. They would have thought, and I'll use a giraffe as an example. They would have thought that if there, or not a giraffe, but a precursor to a giraffe, so a little creature that wanted to eat leaves up high on the trees, as the leaves got eaten, the creature would have to stretch its neck to get higher and higher, to eat more, to stay healthy and to grow and to procreate. And the idea was that maybe over time, after animals kind of stretch themselves out, that these traits would somehow be passed on to their offspring. They didn't know about genes. They didn't know about anything. So this was kind of the general theory. It was put forward by a French scientist named Lamarck. So it's called Lamarckian theory. And this was the mechanism of change, okay, that the best they could think of. So we would say that they thought acquired characteristics could be passed on. If you acquire a characteristic during your life, maybe you're able to pass it on to your offspring, and that's how this trait would grow and spread. And then then your offspring would reach even higher, because a lot of them have higher necks. They would eat the leaves up higher, and your offspring would have to eat higher. They would have to stretch their necks even more. And over generations, you'd get a giraffe, a creature with a huge, long neck, able to eat leaves at the highest of the highest trees. Okay, that's sort of what they thought. Now, just to make sure you understand, though, these ideas floating around were not started in the Enlightenment. This was not a scientific process. The theory of evolution goes all the way back to the materialist philosophers. I found a statement of very much like evolution in 600 BC by a materialist philosopher, Anaximander, in one of my college philosophy books. So materialists, people who did not believe in God, did not believe in creation, have posed some sort of process of change, inherent change over time since ancient times. Lamarck came along in the Enlightenment, and Darwin came along and tried to put this into scientific language, whereas before it was just an entirely philosophical concept. Darwin comes along and writes The Origin of Species in 1859. This is right at the tail end of the Enlightenment. And his process, I think he's turning away from this Lamarckian idea that you can do something in your life and acquire a trait and then pass it on. So he comes up with an articulation of a different process called descent with modification. He thought that things must change just when they're born. They were somehow born slightly different. He didn't know how, because he didn't know about genes. He didn't know about anything. But he thought there's some process by which one creature can have offspring that have some sort of different quality, and then the forces of nature would act upon these different creatures, and some would thrive and some would not, and the ones that thrive would grow and kind of populate the earth. So descent with modification. You probably remember that from school. And in The Origin of Species, he kind of fantasizes about this process of descent with modification acted upon by natural selection as having a very creative ability. It doesn't just distinguish between types of creatures and give some an advantage over others. It can actually create spontaneously all of the different kinds of creatures, from insects to fish to birds to mammals to humans to everything we see on the earth. It's a creative force, even though it's unguided. And so basically with Darwin, what you get is a theory, an idea that's just scientific sounding enough that people are able to embrace it. In the Enlightenment, what were people doing? They were throwing off the church, throwing off God, rejecting the Bible. And this gave them a way to articulate how we all might have gotten here through a purely naturalistic process. And it was just scientific enough. But Darwin didn't have evidence. He didn't have statistics. He didn't have scientific studies. If you read it again, maybe you read it when you were young. If you read it again now, you'll be shocked. It's really just him kind of throwing ideas against the wall. And he's also making a bunch of predictions about what, if this is true, what we will find in the fossil record, none of which really has been found. Certainly not to the degree that he predicted it would have to. We're all sort of, we all remember the finches and the moths from middle school when you first studied Darwin, Darwin's finches and the studies that he did on the Galapagos Islands and elsewhere. You're kind of tempted to think, well, gosh, he did witness evolution, right? I mean, he did this study with the finches. But if you remember, all the finches study was about is that as the weather changes on an island, say, if it's dry one season or if it's wet one season, the seeds that the birds eat would change. Sometimes they're small and hard. Sometimes they're big and juicy. The finches are born with all different kinds of beaks, okay? But depending on what kind of seed is available, your beak, one type of beak might be better suited to eat that seed. And so the birds with those beaks would live longer, they would be healthy, and their numbers would increase in the population. And then when the seeds changed, they would go down, and another kind of population beak would get bigger. But you look at that, you know, and you say, there's no change going on there. Those beaks were already there. They're still finches. It's interesting. It's worth studying. But this process of natural selection has no creative force. The same thing is true with the moths. He did a study in a forest that was near a factory that put off emissions that would kind of alter the color of the bark. If there's dark, soot coming out of the factory, then the tree bark would get darker. And as the tree bark got darker, the dark moths that would land on the trees weren't seen as much by the birds. The lighter moths were seen better against the dark bark, so they would get eaten more. So the dark moth population would increase in relation to the light moths. And then if the factory shut down and the dark, the bark changed back to light, it would go the other way. So he witnessed these things and kind of surmised that look at these forces of natural selection changing these populations. What if over the course of millions or billions of years, similar forces acted on populations and changed them entirely? Okay. So it's all sort of a hypothesis. Don't believe me. Read the book, read the studies. And you'll see there just really not a lot there. I think I was led to believe that there was a lot there in those studies. But when you go back and look at them with sort of a critical eye, you see actually there's this common sense. And the natural selection and microevolution really is common sense. The question is, does it have this incredible creative power to generate whole new types of creatures, whole new body types, whole new populations? Evolutionists believe that it does. So, again, a lot of what Darwin did in The Origin of Species is he predicted that these microevolutionary studies that he did and observations that he made were probably sufficient to then deduce that macroevolution is possible, that moths could change into squirrels, and squirrels could change into horses, and horses, that it had a creative and changing power. And that if that were true, we would find millions, billions, trillions of these transitional fossils in the Earth's crust, because obviously the number of changes that would have been needed to get from that original cell all the way up to the top of the food chain to humans, there'd be trillions and hundreds of trillions of all kinds of very strange creatures that had walked the earth in between there and here, and in between each different type of creature. So he predicted that we would be uncovering these things in future years, and that there, you know, that they would be innumerable. And in the meantime, he and others just kind of continued to use the studies on microevolution as proof, so to speak, of macroevolution. But remember, he didn't know anything about genes. And it wasn't long then after that genes were discovered. Now, what does that do to the theory? On one hand, you know, the evolutionists were kind of excited. Because if you think about it, the idea that I can have a offspring with some kind of different body trait. We all know that within the population, what's going to happen to that body trait over time? Like if I had a child who was kind of freakishly tall, what's going to happen over time? It's going to revert to the mean, because that child is going to marry someone who's much shorter. And it's going to, you know, over time, when we all see this in the populations, we all see this in breeders see it and everything. When you have someone that's outside the mean, the trait gets diluted. Genes, though, so they had a big problem with that. But genes came along and they said, wait a minute, if that trait is written into that kid's code, then that kid may not revert to the mean. That trait may actually be able to be passed along in full in the genes of that child. Okay. So on one hand, it was helpful, but on the other hand, it was very troublesome, because what genes told us is that your body types are locked in. If you have the genes for a bird, you're not going to be a squirrel. Because the genes are the genes. The genes are the code, okay? So on one hand, they were kind of excited about genes. And, well, maybe we have this trait dilution problem solved. On the other hand, they were panicked. Because now it looked like there's no way one body type can ever become another. So what is the theory then that they came up with to theorize of how one body type, one type of creature with one type of set of genes could turn into another type? What's the key phrase? A genetic mutation. Okay. Now, as I walk you through this, remember, this was not discovered. Okay. They walked through it like we're walking through it. They're trying to maintain the ancient materialist idea. They haven't witnessed this. They didn't find it under a microscope. It wasn't the result of a study. They're trying to hold it together as science refutes it over and over. So we have to keep the theory alive. Now we've got this problem of genes. Okay. The only way that I can think of that a creature with one type of genes could turn in, and body type, therefore, could turn into a creature with a whole other type of genes and a whole other type of body type is that some accident was made, some mutation occurred when offspring were born that kind of changed the gene. But problem again, if the change is too big and too sudden, what does it look like? If a squirrel has a baby, and that baby comes out as a rabbit, a cute little rabbit, through genetic mutations, what's the problem? It's too much. It looks like a miracle. It looks like God said, I'm going to create a rabbit, because everybody knows that a gene for a squirrel is way too different. That the idea that a perfect rabbit would come out just with a whole different set of genetics and a whole different way of living and a whole different diet and everything's in place, that would be a miracle. So it can't happen fast. It's got to happen slow. So they started thinking, well, maybe it was small genetic mutations. Very small, because the bigger it is, the more it looks like God did it. But we know God didn't do it. So this could have only been a very small step-by-step process, a very small genetic mutation, almost undetectable to the human eye. And it has to be undetectable to the human eye, or else we'd see it today, but we don't see it. It's because it's so small. Everything is happening so slowly on such a microscopic level that you can't see it. Okay? Is everybody following? So this is how the theory was kept alive. You don't have to read this. I'm going to be using this. But I want to make sure this is kind of the whole theory as best I can summarize it. And we'll go back to that, or I can print it off for you. But I want to make sure you understand what I'm saying here. Okay. So this is how a trait, evolutionists would say, is spreading through a population. We have one creature that is born. What's your name again?
Luke.
Is he a mutant? Ethan? Yeah. We're going to pretend like Luke was born with a mutation, okay? A helpful mutation of some sort. And by helpful, it was random. Nothing his father or mother did, remember, that's Lamarck, pass this mutation on to him. Acquired traits aren't passed along. We all know that. This was a random genetic accident somewhere inside you that can't be seen. It's small, so it's not a miracle, but it's helpful to Luke in some way. It's helpful to Luke. It makes him stronger. It makes him live longer. Okay? And given the environment that he's in, it gives him an advantage somehow within that environment to be stronger and to live longer and to have more offspring than he might otherwise have. Now, it's a tiny change. We want big changes, though. We want to see one creature turn into another, right? So we need a mutation to build upon that mutation. So we need Luke's offspring to have a trait that builds upon the first one. So say he gets, you know, an extra eye. He wants an extra eye, which would give him a great advantage. My mother had one. That already exists. I'll think of something else. No. Think of the eye in the back of the head thing, okay? He can't be born with a whole eye. That would be a miracle. It's too complex. Everybody knows that. Some beginnings of an eye are back there somewhere. Tiny. Minuscule. It still gives him some great advantage, though. Okay? And he's able to have lots of offspring. One of those offspring, then, needs to have an add-on mutation. Again, totally by random forces. It could have had a mutation anywhere. It could have been anything. But it happened to be an add-on to that first part of the eye. Now, what's wrong with that? The odds that Luke would have the first billionth of a complex eye on the back of his head, and that one of his children would randomly get the second billionth, and then the third one would get the third billionth. Everybody knows that can't happen. Okay, so evolutionists scratch their head. All right, how do we increase the odds? Luke has the first step. We need a billion steps, or I'll just say 100. 100 steps to get to a full eye. Each little step giving this creature some kind of advantage. But how do I get to the second step? Because everybody knows, lightning struck once here, it's not going to strike again in his offspring. How do I increase the odds? Well, what I do is I say that little hundredth of an eye is so powerful and gives him such an advantage that over a very short period of time, he gets stronger, he gets bigger, he has tons of offspring, and eventually, given the forces of nature around, that trait, it wipes all of you out, and the entire population now has that hundredth of an eye. Now I've got better odds, right? And this is an odds game. The whole theory is built in how could a random mutation build upon itself. Okay, none of this was discovered, none of this was seen, none of this has ever been witnessed. It's a theory based on randomness. So, his 100th of an eye gives him, we can't see it, it's microscopic, but it gives him such an incredible advantage. He has untold offspring that outperform you all for food and everything else. And so eventually that Now there's a whole population with that first 100th, which means there's a better chance that a random mutation in one of all of us will have the second 100th. And then that one is given such a great advantage that it spreads and takes over the whole population, creating another pool for another random possibility that the third 100th. You see what I'm saying? Okay. Now, I don't know about you. That's not how I learned it in school. I mean, I think all of that was kind of glossed over. Was that the first time any of you kind of started to understand how the process worked, or did you already know? Was I the only one? When I started to realize this, I mean, that was step one for me. When I started to realize this whole thing is made up, okay? Nobody has seen that. Nobody has witnessed that. And, you know, to read the scientific journals and read some of the books on evolution, and again, reading them is the best cure for evolution. Don't read the creationists. Don't read the Christian stuff. Read their stuff. And you won't believe what you're reading, okay? That when I started to see this unfolding before me, I began to realize there's a real problem here. Because that doesn't make any common sense. What is the death knell to that whole process that I just described to you? Who can put their finger on the nugget, the issue that just wipes that whole idea out? You mean the in-between ones? Yeah, yeah. Where are all the transitional fossils? The missing link is still missing, folks. That's why it's on the cover of Time magazine every 3 years. Because they know it's still the missing link. 3 years later, no, now we really found the missing link. That's why. They don't have it. There is none. All of those, that's one issue. But think about this. That, how could that mutation back here at one time be so tiny that no one can see it, no one would detect it, and yet at the same time give him such an incredible advantage that his offspring would wipe out the entire population and replace you all with offspring with that trait? How can that be? When evolutionists ask themselves that question, you know what their answer is? It must have. Those traits must have had such power because look at all the variation. And I'm not exaggerating. Read them. That's what they say. We don't know how, but it had to have given him an advantage. It has to be microscopic because if it's too big and too complex, it's a miracle. And it has to be so powerful that it gives him an incredible advantage that that trait will take over the whole population. How do you know? It has to be because look at all the variation. It's circular. I mean, there's all kinds of problems with this. The other problem, the main problem, well, those are all real problems. Another terrible problem is there ain't enough time for that to happen over and over and over and over for every kind of creature on the earth. There is not enough time, folks. Think of the odds of what we're talking about here. For that little fishy to randomly develop the little muscles, to have it crawl up on land, and then to have its offspring take over, and then to have the next iteration of those things, and the next, and the next, and the next. We're talking an amount of time that is unfathomable. And yet, remember, natural selection. The theory of evolution would say it actually had to happen fast enough to keep up with the changing environment. So, I mean, we got some real problems here. You know that can't happen in a short amount of time, but if the climate's changing in 100,000 years or 1,000 years, this stuff needs to pick up. So what do scientists do? What they need more than anything is time. Okay, if you want to walk into a room and say that you believe that process just happened and not be thought of as kind of a nut, You have to believe. That there has been so much time for this to happen. Not 10,000 years, not 100,000 years, not a billion years. You need so much time that when I tell you how much time, your eyes start to glaze over. I need it to be so much time that no one can imagine it, really. Or else I look like a fool. If I say that happened in a million years, everybody knows that didn't happen. If I say it happened in a billion years, everybody knows that didn't happen. I need more time. Okay? So now you begin to understand why the fight over age. Age of the earth. Age of the universe. They have to have an inconceivable amount of time for that process that I just talked about. And it has to be inconceivable so that no one can really think they understand how much time, or else you could start to calculate it and you could probably disprove it. So they just go back. Billions and billions. Oh, okay. Billions. We can't really conceive of 1 billion. They say that the age of the earth is, 4.5 to 5 billion, and the universe is 16.5 billion. We don't know how. We can't conceive of that much time. But that's the problem. That's the debate that rages now. Because, like I said, everybody knows. And in fact, it has been statistically calculated as statistically impossible that the sheer forces of nature could organize the most basic life forms. I mean, the calculations have been done. It is statistically impossible. So I just need so much time to where I don't look foolish anymore by saying that something that's obviously impossible happened. Because the more time you have, the more you lose your ability to critique me. And I'll just, maybe I'm belaboring this point, but I think it's really important. If I were to say that lightning is going to strike right here 1,000 times in 1,000 years, what would you say? Crazy. What about 1,000 times in 100,000 years? Yes or no? No. What about 1,000 times in 10 million years? Still no. Maybe my example isn't very good. But what if I said 1,000 times in a trillion years right here? Now you can't say. See? It's not that I'm right, but you can't say definitively no. That's the game, all right? Again, I'm jumping up and down on this horse. I told you, beating the dead horse, jumping up and down. Okay, whatever. Time makes me get nervous. So you remember that process I told you about and how statistically impossible it is. And we all know that, and evolutionists know that. But if I pose enough time, if I said I think that happened in 100,000 years, everybody would say, no. If I said it happened in a million years, everybody would say, I don't think so. But if I go back 4.5 billion years, an amount of time you can't conceive of, you kind of have to confess that, at what point is anything possible, But so that's the game. I need enough time going back to make you uncomfortable declaring that it definitively didn't happen. Now I've got you. It might have happened. Right? It might have happened. Lightning might strike here 1,000 times in 100 million years. You said it yourself. So now we're on the same team. You see the game? So time becomes critical, and trying to show people that there has been a ton of time here on earth for this to happen is really important. Okay? So how do we make sure that everybody is on the same page and understands that there's been an incredible amount of time for all of this to happen? Brad? Yeah. No, we're going to get there. We're going to get there, actually. The idea, the laws of physics and the the law of entropy and the idea that things are running out, that creatures are going extinct, populations are going extinct, but they're not growing, they're not building. That's a big problem for evolutionists. But right now, I'm focused on this issue of time still. Okay, we've got to find time. Or this whole theory is going down the tubes. So how do we find the time that we need? Everybody's seen the chart. You remember from your textbooks in middle school and high school and college how the fossils break down and the geologic periods and so forth. This is used by scientists to support the idea of this evolutionary progression, the simple to complex. Simple are way down deep in the earth strata, and eventually, animals got more and more complex. And as you get to the top, you finally get to humans. This kind of idea was created using index fossils. So what they do is they dig up creatures and they kind of arrange them based on complexity. And they determine which ones were more simple, which ones are more complex, and they put them in an order from simple to complex, okay? And so they index them. So then if they find a new creature and it has a certain level of complexity, they'll slide it in where they think it must have come in the evolutionary history. And then they present the column to you as proof. So they order the body types the way they think they ought to be ordered. And then they show you in your textbook that over the course of all these billions of years, this has been how the change occurred. You probably thought that there was a lot more proof than there is for this order. But as I studied it, what I realized is there's not really. In fact, there's not any for the order. The order is taking a bunch of jumbled fossils and putting them in an order. And scientists disagree on the order. As obviously, as you get any two people to order them, they're going to be different. Okay. The way that they have decided they can determine that this geologic column is so old is by attributing to sedimentary layers many, many, many years to be laid down. If you think about it, they say the Earth is between 4.5 and 5 billion years old. The principal rocks in the Earth's crust are sedimentary rocks. They would say that each layer represents probably millions of years, thousands, if not millions, and millions in some cases. And they break those layers down into eras and epochs and things, okay? But the problem is, what do you know about fossils? If you find a fossil in a sedimentary layer, what do you know about that layer? It had to be laid down pretty quick. Because what happens if you leave a creature on the surface of the earth for 1,000 years? It becomes dust pretty quickly, actually. I said 1,000 years, but I mean, a creature will decay out in the elements very quickly. So to fossilize, it has to be covered up very quickly. But we ignore that. We also ignore the fact that trees have been found fossilized, cutting across sometimes 40 layers of fossilized layers. Okay. An entire tree. Obviously, each one of those layers did not take 1 million years to be laid down. There's any number of debates like this that go on to show that you cannot just say that a layer of sedimentary rock was laid down over 1 million years. But I'll leave it there for now, except to say that nobody has found evidence of a meteor strike below the top layer of the Earth's surface. So if these surfaces, each of them, were exposed for millions of years, certainly someone would have found evidence of a meteor strike below the top surface now, but there has never been one found. Interesting factoid. But here's the bigger thing. That column is not found in nature. Okay? If you were to dig down in the Earth's crust, you would not find that order, either of the fossils from complex down to simple, and you would not find the layers in the order that they appear in your textbook. Again, those have been assembled. So if I find a very complex creature in this layer, even though it was very deep, I use my index and I say, well, that must have at one point been very high in the Earth's strata. So I move it. Remember last week I told you about being at the Grand Canyon and the nice lady with the Smokey the Bear hat was walking us around and she pointed to this layer that, that used to be 10 layers up. And I just went, wow, that's amazing. Years later, I thought, how does she know that? How can an entire layer of the earth move? It's because they found a fossil out of order, so they need it to move. That's how they build the column. It's not in the earth's crust. So I actually found this little factoid, the second bullet in my studies, that 80 to 85% of the earth's land surface doesn't contain even three of the periods in any correct order. I mean, that's kind of amazing. Robert? Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting science. And, you know, they have the. Yeah, interesting. Well, I'd like to hear more about that from you. We're going to have to wrap it up because we're out of time. But next week, we're going to talk about carbon dating, radiometric dating, and some ice core stuff. And then hopefully we'll get in more deeper into genetics and mutations. And eventually, you know, like I said, what you're going to see is there is a lot less there than you might think, may have thought. Okay? So I hope you're starting to see that. Let me pray and close this out. Father, we thank you for your grace and mercy. We thank you for your word. We thank you for your truth. And Lord, we ask you to guide us deeper into this study. Help us to see just our ability as a human race to suppress the truth, to deceive one another. Lord, to the degree that we have allowed ourselves to be deceived, we ask for your forgiveness and we ask you, Lord, to open our eyes and help us to see the depth and the reality and the truth of your word as spoken. Forgive us if we ever didn't believe you based on rumors and ideas and machinations and schemes that we should have seen. Lord, we worship you and we thank you and we trust you and we trust your word. And we just thank you that you would share it with us and put it down in words. Drill it down into our hearts, Lord. Help us to see it and help us to know that you are near, that you're the creator of all things, and that everything you say and have told us about ourselves and our world and about Christ and heaven and hell are all real and true. We ask you now to be with us as we worship together in song and by examining your word together. And we pray that your name would be glorified and that Jesus Christ would be glorified for all he has done for his people in dying on the cross and in taking up his life again to be raised from the dead so that we can worship a living Lord. And we pray all these things in his holy name. Amen.